All right, hey everyone, this is Maddie Kay, and this is The Working Experience.
The Working Experience.
Route 93 North is almost at a standstill. It's a rough one out there this morning, snow and sleet.
There is no service on
that. Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Yeah, folks, we're going to be a few minutes. We have train traffic ahead of us. We should be moving shortly.
John, we need that report ASAP.
Where are we on that presentation?
Man, HR wants to see you.
Did you return that email yet?
We have a team meeting at 10.
To stay late, Bob.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
We're moving in a different direction.
And after the meeting, we'll have a breakout session.
Who ate my
Where are my hot pockets?
This microwave is disgusting.
Oh, God, what's that
He was clipping his toenails at his desk. I can't take it anymore.
All right, hey, everyone. This is Maddie Kay, and with...
John.
With John, and this is another episode of The Working Experience. We have a few topics to touch on today, but one I would like to start with. Yesterday I read this story about, this was just a very short blurb on Facebook, about a guy who was flying from Chicago to Beijing, and the flight had to take an emergency landing, or make an emergency landing, in Alaska, because apparently this guy went and shit all over two of the bathrooms. And at first I thought, you know, this was like he had a terrible accident or something, but apparently it was deliberate. Like, he went in and he smeared, you know, his crap all over the bathrooms. Like, I don't know why they didn't get a lot of details in the story, but I do remember, this was years ago, this is probably 15 years ago, maybe longer, where a guy got totally drunk on a flight, which is not uncommon, and he managed to actually take a shit on the service tray. Like, apparently he got cut off and was irate about this, and so this was his protest. I don't know how he managed that. I don't know how, but this was like pre-Facebook, so this was a long time ago. You know, this was on the national news.
Wait, sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, it was on the national news. Like, it was on television. They, like, this guy, you know, I don't know. That was the story. He got drunk and then he took a dump on the service tray.
Well, you know, it's evolution. You know, it's not too long ago in the evolution of man that we were apes,
yep,
and monkeys.
Yeah.
And you know, you go to the zoo and you see a monkey take a shit in their hand.
Yep.
And you know, they throw it at another monkey.
Right.
Or maybe they smear it on the window.
Right.
So when you got, you know, humans in a confined tube,
yeah,
and they're going to act out, they might shit all over the bathroom or take a dump on the tray.
Right, know, right.
It's and these stories fascinate me because it's something that would be the furthest thing from my mind.
Yeah.
Of like what state of being do you have to be to just go, you know what? Because this is like peeling an onion.
Right.
Once you decide to go in there and completely destroy the bathroom by shitting all over it, right?
Yeah.
You're affecting every single person on that plane, one. Then you're affecting the cleanup crew,
right,
who has to go in and clean it. And like you said, with this flight, it had to be diverted because of human shit.
Right.
It's like,
right.
And what do you then open that door and like look over your shoulder and be like, I showed them. I won.
I won.
I won. It's just unbelievable.
Well, and then as it relates to more of the working experience, a woman responded with a story on Facebook. So I'm reading her story. I don't know who she is, but it says, when I worked in Campbellville, Kentucky at IntelNet Global, there was a woman like that. She would go into the bathroom stalls at work and smear feces on the toilet, stall walls, stall door, etc. Now, I don't know what the etc. would be. When she had that time of the month, in quotes, she also spread that around. Now, that is utterly... I mean, this is like a crime scene, you know? Like, this is just beyond the pale.
Now,
I mean,
now, did the article... did they catch the smearer?
Oh, this goes... Hold on. One or more of the women knew she was doing it because they had gone to school with her and she had done the same thing.
Oh,
so this Lord. Is years... I mean, this is not just about she's mad. I mean, we had the... you had the conversation with our friend Tom about the woman who was defecating on the floor because she was mad at someone in her office and they caught her. But, I mean, that's messed up enough. But at least, I guess, she had some point. This woman's been doing this for years. Like, it was in school, it's at her work. It doesn't really matter. Okay, so it says... she had done the same thing. Since they hadn't caught her in the act, there was no way to prove who it was for quite some time. We faced that several times a week for months before they caught her and fired her. It was an awful experience for the rest of us, having to inspect the stall each time we went to the ladies' room so we wouldn't accidentally shut the door of any stall behind us, only to find ourselves locked in with the mess. Has to be a really sick mental illness. But even a person with that mental illness is able to get a job. You know?
Yeah. I just, again, like the state of mind that you're in to go there. First of all, like, I'm assuming that she's taking her own shit and smearing it, correct?
Yeah, one would assume, yes.
Okay, the initial shock of that smell.
Oh God!
Would just I it would immobilize me. I don't know if I could carry through the full smear campaign. I might get one stroke in, and then I'd have to bow out.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's how, like, when you watch, like, you know those shows on MSNBC, like Locked Up Raw? Like, those guys who have been in solitary confinement for 20 years do stuff like that. Because they're mentally ill. I mean, they're nuts. You know, they're like...
Right.
But this woman, I mean, she's just working at a job.
Well, that's like, you know, it's like the worst thing that you can conceivably do to a human being is put them in solitary confinement.
Right.
Like, it's worse than putting... same said human being in, you know, in general population with murderers, rapists, you know.
Yeah.
Worse than that is solitary confinement.
Yeah.
It just completely destroys you physically and mentally.
But, you know, this woman obviously wasn't dealing with that. And
no.
I take it from the tone of the title of the company and the, you know, went to school with her. She's a college graduate. I mean, I'm not saying that people who are non-college graduates are more prone to do that, but it's like, you know.
Statistically speaking.
Right. So, I don't know. I just, it's one of those things that I guess, and again, though, but, you know, we heard this story from someone we know personally. We heard, not this story, but the story about the woman he worked with. And it's like, what? I mean, like, this is how you handle adversity? Like, this is how you deal with the world? I don't know.
And the poor woman co-worker
would
just be, like, you know, waiting for the next smear campaign, right? They'd be treading in fear.
For some reason...
opening that door.
Yeah, and I think of this, maybe it's my sexism coming out. I think of this as more of a guy thing. Like, I don't know why. Like, I don't picture a woman doing this. But, I mean, the menstrual thing, too, that really freaks me out. That is like, oh, my God. That is just...
That's one for the books right
there. So, to shift gears a little bit, I was watching MSNBC this morning, the Your Business show. And they reiterated the Gallup poll of 7 out of 10 people being miserable, or what I like, emotionally neutral about their job. And, you know, I just encountered this, and again, not naming names or anything like that, but someone coming back to work and saying they were so depressed about being, this was after the Christmas holidays, you know, just so depressed about being there and whatnot. And I thought, like, I don't know how you get up every day and come, you know, and I, as I've said before, I like my job quite a bit. So I'm like, I don't understand, like, why, you know, but apparently that's 7 out of 10 people. So then went on to talk about millennials, which you had mentioned, and, you know, wanting, like, one issue they brought up was fair pay. Like, millennials have a lot more access to understanding pay scales for different industries. Like, I guess there's something called salary.com and something called payscale.com. And, you know, they want a more competitive salary, so they're going to be much more upfront about asking what that is and about the salary. And the woman made the point that, like, ping pong tables and free lunches and foosball at work isn't going to cut it anymore. Like, that's not what people are looking for.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, too, with, you know, with millennials, it's not just money. It's also, you know, a sense of accomplishment.
They got to that, yeah.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
You know, and a sense of meaning, you know, that's really, it's really lacking, you know, in some jobs, in some industries. So I think that's what they're, you know, that's what they're, you know, longing for. That's what they're looking for. Well, yeah, but, it, you know, just going back to the statistic of 7 out of 10 people hate their job.
Yes, 7 out of 10.
That's, like, was the impetus to start this, you know, this podcast, is because it is, it's really not talked about in society as a whole. Of, you know, you'll have your, you know, you'll have your articles here and there, or you'll have your statistics, and then everyone's like, yeah, that's true, and then they, you know, they schlep off to work. And, you know, and for some people, you know, it sucks. Their hands are tied. They have the mortgage. They have the kids. They have the car payments. They, you know, it's like, oh, it's all good. It's all, you know, it's great to, like, yeah, I hate my job. But, you know, what's the alternative? And
right.
Nobody, like, makes a plan. And it's always like this, you know, this endless cycle of, you know, maybe, you know, they're hitching their hopes on the next self-help book, or maybe they're drowning their reality in alcohol or drugs, or maybe they're taking it out on the wife and kids. You know, it's anything than actually, you know, taking a constructive step to get out of your current situation.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that I think this guy and this woman who were talking, one guy, I can't remember the name of it, but he has an athletic franchise, like gyms and stuff like that. So he was talking about, like, trying to keep people interested. And I mean, some of it sounded awful. It was like having them put on skits and stuff like that, the new employees, and doing dress-up days and things like that. And, you know, he seemed very sincere. And he was like, I just want people not to take themselves too seriously, but take the job seriously. The problem is, I think that kind of falls under the ping-pong tables and the foosball and the free lunch. It's like, okay, yeah, but money is what, you know, money... is going to keep people interested. But another guy made the point that what a lot of young people want is, like, learning and development. Like, they want to be challenged. They want to, like, one, I don't know if it was Uber or Amazon. It's a big company now, but when they were a startup, the CEO would bring in case studies from Harvard Business School, where he graduated, and he would have them work on them. And I guess that really motivated them to be like, you know, oh, we're learning how to build a business. Like, yeah, let's, like, in terms of, like, or as a replacement for money, you got to provide incentive for growth, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, you know, and this is very specific on, you know, the U.S. And, of course, you know, we're talking about issues that are global in nature. But it's like in the U.S. of, like, what we value, you know, the society as a whole, you know, values success, money, power. And it's kind of, you know, our lovely current President Trump kind of embodies that American success, power at all costs, at the cost of health, relationships, time. When you take a country like Denmark, where, you know, they get, I think it's 6 weeks paid vacation, and everybody takes it. And if you don't take it, you know, you're considered absolutely crazy. They have 9 months paid maternal leave for mothers. They have 3 months paid paternal leave for fathers. And in the U.S., I think I just read an article, and the statistic is the average American gets 14 vacation days, and the majority take less than half of that.
Oh, so Jesus.
They get 14 days, and the vast majority, I think the number was over 70%, take less than half of those days, and instead of taking the time off, will either bank the days or take the money for the days. which is just, you know, yeah. It's like, do you, you know, live to work or work to live?
Well, and now, I think even
in Denmark,
when
Denmark, you know, there's a trade-off. Like, taxes are very, very high.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think the marginal rate is well over 50%. But the social safety net there is, you know, it's unbelievable. If you lose your job, I think you get like 80% of your salary until you find another job. It's just, it's ridiculous. Like, healthcare for most part is free. Education is free. And it's like, what do we as a society, and this is not, you know, I'm not saying we should, you know, take on the Denmark model, you know, lockstep and foot. It's just very interesting, like, where our, you know, where we're headed as a society and what we value. I guess it's what we value. And you see, like, and then on the other end of the extreme, and like, and I think we spoke about this in, like, Japan, where you have, and there's a Japanese word for it, where it's like, it's an honor to work yourself to death. And like, Japanese businessmen will work like 20 hours and then go to a local bar and drink themselves into oblivion and then fall down somewhere on the streets and sleep there and then get up and go to, was it suit men? What was the, didn't we have this discussion?
Salary men.
No. Salary men, yeah.
And you someone actually, other? Someone draws a chalk outline around them. I think
right,
a cop.
So they don't get, out of the courtesy, they don't get stepped on.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
That is nice.
But you know, it really comes down to, like, how do you, like, how do you want to, you know, and a lot of people don't think they have control. They don't think they can make that change, and change is scary. They think they're locked into this this job that they, you know, have these specific skill set for, and they've got a mortgage, and they've got a wife, and they've got kids, and they've got, you know, a car payment, and, you know, they need this job. And then just more shit get, their tolerance for the shit getting piled on top of them is enormous.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, It's funny, because I don't know how, like, this was indicating millennials were kind of seeking more of what you're talking about. Like, one thing was, you know, asking about flexible work hours. Like, you know, the guy, and again, I'm reiterating what the guy said on MSNBC, that there really aren't 9-to-5s anymore. Like, the 9-to-5 job doesn't really exist. people are looking for maternity and paternity leave and job sharing. I'm not really sure what job sharing means, but...
So job sharing would be, you know, there's one position, and instead of one person taking it, two or more people would take that same position and quote-unquote job share. So if there was like 40 hours for this one position, if you were a graphic designer, then one person might take 25 and the other person might take 15. So they're quote-unquote sharing the job.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, they wanted flexibility. And right. But the guy also made the point, the caveat, you know, technology makes working more flexible. You can work from home. You know, you don't necessarily have to be in the office, but you're on call like 24/7. Like, they always have access
right,
to
you're
you.
Yeah, you're always on.
When it used to be like, you're out of the office at 5:30, that's it. I mean, I suppose someone could call you at home, but I think that was kind of rare. And, like, you know, my dad had his own law practice, but it was very clearly delineated. Like, clients did not call the house except on a very rare occasion. And he, if it happened, you know, he was always very like, I mean, I heard him on the phone once or twice being like, yeah, call me at the office, and basically hang up, being like, look, I'm home now. Like, you know, right, we don't do that. But now it's like, I mean, I get emails from parents. I get emails from students. I'll come in the next morning and a kid will be like, did you get my email last night? And I'll check. And it was like, sent at 10:30. I'm like, no, I didn't, actually. I was asleep. But
Yeah, right.
But they're so used to, like...
Yeah, no, I think in just to comment on that last thing, I think in France, they just passed a law where it's illegal to text, call, or email your employees, like, after 6 o'clock. Like, it's an actual law where the company can get fined.
Well, you know, it's sad that the government has to step in and do that, but it's sort of like, leave me alone, like, for God's sake, like, right. I'm trying to talk to my kid about his day.
It's tough because, like, I own a business.
Well, you're on, like, 24/7.
My hours are definitely not 9 to 5.
Right.
Sometimes I'm working on LA time, sometimes I'm working on London time, sometimes I'm working on Mumbai time.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, and I readily accept that because the trade-offs for me is I can drive my sons to school in the morning.
Right.
Or I can make that soccer game. Or I can, you know, my for the most part, I mean, obviously there's, when I'm in productions, things are like very, very crazy. But
right.
For the most part, I cherish that flexibility where I can, literally, I don't have to stay at the office late. I can literally come home and literally pick up right where I left off on something that 10 years ago, I would have had to been on a machine that cost $250,000.
Right.
You know, now I can literally have the exact same mirror set up in my home that I have in my office.
Right.
So there's like, and the same thing too is like, you know, with technology and turning off, there it's not black and white, you know, it's really how, you know, this is with anything, it's like, it's really your, like, your perspective and like how you have to set boundaries and control it on your end. Like, just because, you know, someone can email you at 10:30 or text you at 10:30. Doesn't mean that you have to sleep with your phone on your nightstand.
Yes, I do. You know? Right on the pillow. Oh, yeah. Right next to me, leaping up.
Or just, you know, turn off your cell phone. You know? Yeah. And I read another article about I can't remember the statistic. I don't know if you're in front of a computer, you look it up. It's like the amount of people that if given the choice between having their cell phone or having sex, they would choose their cell phone.
Oh, jeez.
Over having, and it's not all about sex, but let's just turn like human contact,
like,
right?
Intimacy with your partner.
Yeah, an intimacy, human connection. I'm gonna choose a piece of hardware.
Yep.
that will give me dopamine hits for likes and, ooh, someone likes me. Ooh, someone likes this post. You know, I'll take that over a hug or a smile or a kiss.
Yep.
It's like, and I don't know, maybe it's, maybe it's like old, I don't know. It's, you know, the other thing too is like technology is changing so rapidly, so fast that we're not able to kind of catch up with like the moral and human implications of this. And this directly applies to the workplace of like how we work and how we manage our time and how much time is just wasted in an average work week. And, you know, it's really interesting.
Well, you know, I've noticed, like, with emails, like, it seems like there has to be three times as many emails to sort of get to the same point as, like, I don't know, where if somebody just, like, came in, or if we just spoke face-to-face, it would take about 25 seconds. But, like, this email comes out, and that email, oh, did you get my email? Okay, about what? About who are we talking about again? Like, it gets very confusing where it's like, and you know, you don't know somebody's tone.
Yeah, everyone gets CC'd, so you cover your ass.
Right. And it's like, what are we talking about again? Like, what was that? Did you get this? Did you get that from? Like, yeah. Well, you know what I was picturing is, you know, a father or a mother sitting at the computer and the child saying, you know, mommy, daddy, I love you. And you're like, yeah, that's okay. But I have to see how many likes I got on my last so, listen, honey, I'm very, that's great and everything, but I'm very busy right now, okay?
Yeah, you know, I just read this kind of switching gears but a little bit related, is this article on you know, Paul Logan, I think I'm pronouncing his name right. He's a huge YouTuber,
and no.
He's like this 22-23 year old, and he's, you know, he's made multi-millions of dollars with his YouTube channel, and same with his brother. And he was just recently in the news for going to the Japanese suicide forest. Did you read this story?
No.
Okay, so like there's a forest in Japan that's notorious where people go to commit suicide. So he went to the forest and came across a guy who had hung himself.
Oh, and Jesus.
Posted the video, and just like it was very, very inappropriate how he dealt with the situation, and it was very shocked to he's like, I came across this, can't believe this, blah blah blah, just to, you know, garner views. And he got a lot of backlash, a lot of criticism for it. And you know, this here's a kid who literally is filming his life. It's like vlogs and kind of. He started out like on Vine. It's like kind of like prank stuff, and now the kid is massive. He's like one of the biggest YouTube stars. The guy makes like over $10 million a year.
Jeez.
Just from his YouTube channel, and he's now got a clothing line. He's got all this stuff. And his job is essentially like allowing or documenting his life for the world to see. And then he'll do like stupid stuff, like, you know, light, throw his mattress in his pool and light that on fire. Needless to say, his neighbors hate him. He'll just do like crazy, crazy stunts.
Yeah.
You know, to gain views. But, you know, that quote unquote job didn't exist, you know, 8 years ago.
Right.
Like when YouTube was just coming out, you couldn't make any money on it. Nothing whatsoever. Now he's got brand sponsorship deals. He's got apparel deals. He's got, you know, you name it. So that's another kind of, you know, interesting thing, not a 9-to-5-er, right? He's literally going kind of 24/7.
Well, yeah, I think that's what, you know, when I guess maybe kids in high school and whatnot think about careers, like, they see someone like that, or I saw someone the other day. I mean, apparently he talks to the camera and he just, like, reveals all this really heartrending stuff about his life and he cries. And he had, like, 8 million views. And I was like, well, I mean, you know, more power to him. I guess we're trying to get on YouTube. But, yeah, when people talk about, you know, actually going to an office and sitting down for, you know, 8 hours and having a half hour for lunch, the, you know, people who are like 25, 26, that's not their model. And I mean, I guess there's just a lot more like job jumping around. There's a lot more like cross-pollination. There's a lot more, well, one of these lists I had from Forbes said, you know, things not, we talked about this, things not to say in a job interview. Like, I'm a writer, an editor, and a web designer, and a da-da-da-da-da, like, too much of a jack of all trades. But I think that's really, I don't think that's great advice. I think maybe a 30-year-old who's looking for a 23-year-old wants them to have a lot of those skills.
Right, right.
You know, whereas, you know, for me, it's like, what do you do? Like, I remember when I was starting out in the film industry and I had business cards made up and it would say, like, production assistant, grip, electric, and somebody saw it and said, no, 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 pick something. Like, put that you're a grip. Like, people want to know what you do. They don't want to see grip and hair makeup. Like, that doesn't, you know, they want you to have that skill set. And I was like, oh, okay, that was good advice. And then people got to know me as a grip, and that's how I was hired. But in the technology world, it just seems a lot more blurred lines, I guess I would say.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, and that's what's like, you know, fascinating for me. It's just everyone has their story and their kind of unique, you know, footprint in this world. And, you know, just kind of like, it always fascinates me of like what people, you know, what people do, you know, the vast, you know, array of jobs out there. And, you know, and also, you know, just how, you know, people interact with each other, you know, and these crazy stories, you know. It's just, it's entertaining and fascinating to me.
Well, you know, we're reading, and I finished the book. I had never read it, Into the Wild, that Chris McCandless guy. He went into Alaska. He ended up dying at the age of 24. But he came from a affluent family in Virginia. He graduated from Emory with like a 4.0. He donated $25,000 to Oxfam, which was his trust fund to go to law school. And, right, you know, he just took off and he ditched his car and his identity. He burned his cash and he had this odyssey around the United States. And then he ended up going up to Alaska and, you know, he lasted for 120 days. And unfortunately, he starved to death because he ate something that he shouldn't have. You know, here was a guy, I keep making the point to my class that he did all of this by choice, whereas there's a big population that kind of drifts around from job to job. My brother and I were talking about it when he lived in Breckenridge, Colorado, and encountered these people that he lived with who, they were cooks, they would clean rooms, they would do this, they would do that, and they just kind of drifted around. Like, that's what they did, you know, low pay, low skill jobs. They would go from this resort town to that resort town, and that's a big population in this country, I think. And these are, you know, native born Americans who are doing that. You know, migrant labor has been here for a long time. That's kind of a different issue. But, you know, this guy, he just kind of gave it all up. And now he died unexpectedly. You know, once he had done all of that, who knows what he would have, you know, done after. But he, and this was 1994, so this was, you know, well before people were sort of you know, breaking out of that, maybe not well before, but, you know, people have really broken out of that model of, I just get this job and this is my job for life and I'm there from 9 to 5 and da da da, you know, like your friend, the young lady who's done a little bit of work for us. I mean, she, I guess, has been trying to build a travel brand, and there's something called van life where people just travel around. And I was reading about that in the New Yorker, and they're on Instagram and they've gotten some sponsorship, and people are just fascinated by that. Like being able to load up a VW bus and quit your job and drive on out. But they said it's not exactly what you think it is either. Like, it's not as glamorous as you would think.
Yeah. And you know, there's like, you hear, it's just like in business, you hear about all the, you know, success stories. And right. You don't hear about the thousands or tens of thousands of people that just haven't made it.
Yeah.
You know, or surviving on pennies when you think they're millionaires.
Right.
But you know, it's a, look, and work, jobs, making money is constantly in a state of evolution. Like, we're, you know, I wonder when my boys are my age, like, is AI a reality? You know, is a robot going to be driving trucks? You know, will a job that I started out at, I started out as an editor, and you know, there's, you know, is that going to be taken over by AI technology, where you have essentially a computer that's equipped with artificial intelligence, create a rough cut out of the best selects, and then a human comes in and puts the final creative touches on it and saves hundreds of hours.
Yeah. Well, look at digital cameras.
What's that?
Look at digital cameras. Like, on a film set, you would have loaders. You'd have maybe, like, on a big shoot.
That. Yep.
You'd have like 6 loaders, and that was a pretty well-paid job. And then you would have the second AC, you'd have the first AC, and, you know, dealing with the film stocks and all of that. Now that's a tech, I think, who comes with the camera that you rent. There's no loaders anymore. There's no, whole position's
like
gone.
There's like a DIT, there's a direct, you know, which is in charge of like loading the cards.
Right.
But I remember that where you had 10 minute, you had 10 minutes to get the shot, right? And you would constantly be, every time you would change that cartridge, you constantly have to check that there was nothing in there, like no dust got in there. It was almost like a surgical procedure.
You know, it's amazing. I got to watch that a lot, and I got to actually work on some movies that used film, that still used film, and I got to see the AC get in there with the squeeze air. To squeeze out, like you were just talking about, all the dust, and you had to make sure like the lens was clear, and
right.
And there was also focus issues. You really had to, you could not tell in a film camera if the focus was soft or not. At, you know, they had focus pullers, and
right.
I'm just remembering all this now, like all these positions, and now, you know, you would have 3 minutes on a roll of film, and you had to get that shot. Otherwise,
right.
You just it was $100 for the roll of film, and it was $100 to not produce, but to develop that roll. So you had
right.
to be...
I remember the cost was astronomical.
Well, and the thing that was interesting was when they went over to digital, and a lot of people have said this, I remember one guy saying, I don't want to hear fix it in post. I am sick of hearing that because... He said, it has made filmmaking so sloppy. And like, one shoot I was on, we were so far behind schedule. And I was the key grip. And the people were on our backs about it. And I was like, why is this my fault? And I finally went over to the script supervisor. Or we were just talking. And I was like, what's up with this? And she said, we're doing 9 takes for every shot. Because it doesn't cost them any money. Literally, these 2 kids walking down a flight of steps. We were on our 9th take. I'm like, what is going on here? And they'll shoot hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage because it doesn't cost. Whereas with film, you had to get that. And, you know, one or two takes, that was it. And you were, so that, I've always liked that because it's a very specific example of technology knocking out a bunch of positions and changing the nature of the way that films were shot or are shot.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's really, I mean, we've seen it, you know, we've seen it in, you know, just working in the industry, and like 20 years from now, I can only imagine.
Did you did you ever work on stuff that used film?
Yeah, I worked on, believe it or not, it's going way back, commercials. And I worked on one feature documentary that used film.
Yeah, well, were you the producer on it?
I was the editor on it.
Well, I can only...
I was an associate producer, too. I was on the set, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I can imagine the pressure being like, look, we are literally burning money through that camera. Like, let's get this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it was intense.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, you know, waiting for it to develop, you know, and making, you know, watching the dailies to make sure that you didn't screw it up.
Spider-Man.
You screw it up, you know, you've got, like, you know, soft focus, or you had, like, you know, dust in the gate and it's on the thing. I mean, you've got to then go back to that location, secure the location, get the... So it's not just that you burnt through the...
Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
$100 for...
Right.
I mean, it was like a mistake in the tens of thousands of dollars.
That's the phrase, check the gate. They would say checking the gate, and I guess you don't really... I remember on one shoot, they were using a digital camera, and someone kept calling. I think the AD would be like, all right, check the gate. And then he'd be like, yeah, we aren't checking the gate anymore. He was just so used to saying it. That, well, someone told me a story. It was Spider-Man 2, I think. And they had a shot where they had to pull the camera over the arc of the Brooklyn Bridge. It was hooked up to a truck. And it was this, you know, massive shot where I guess, like, Spider-Man swinging on the rope or whatever it was. The whole day, or like 2 days, was spent on this shot. Setting it up, da-da-da, this and that. They do it. They get it back. Focus is soft.
Oh.
And they fired the entire camera crew. And, you know.
Oh, my God.
But you wouldn't know. Like, there was no way to know. And,
There's no way to know.
Yeah. So.
Maybe we should wrap this guy up.
Yeah. All right. So, thanks a lot for listening, everybody. Another podcast of The Working Experience.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.